Let's begin today, right now, by looking at the idea that invasive plants are messengers. Timothy Lee Scott, a healthcare practitioner in Vermont and wild plant man, has told quite an insightful tale in his book, Invasive Plant Medicine, The Ecological Benefits and Healing Abilities of Invasives. I believe after hearing what he's got to say, we will all have one more reason to wonder why shoot the messenger. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Tim, welcome, and thanks so much for your time today.
Hi, Robin. Thank you for having me.
Before we get started, I just gave you a very brief introduction. Why don't you tell us what kind of healthcare practitioner you are and if there's a more formal version of a wild plant man?
Well, I'm an acupuncturist and herbalist in Brattleboro, Vermont, and have been in practice here since 2002. More recently, focusing more on chronic diseases and Lyme disease.
You have a quote in the beginning of your book from the 2005 Interagency Task Force of Federal Government Scientists and NASA, which is, America is under siege by invasive species. They are the single most formidable threat of natural disaster of the 21st century. If this weren't so blindsided, it would be comical.
Yes. I've been hearing about these tales about these plants for many years now. About 3 years ago, I began writing an article for myself more to vent some of my frustrations about this paradigm of invasive species. It all started with realizing that most of these plants that have been deemed invasive and noxious are actually valuable herbs that have been used for thousands of years, in many cases in Asian medicine. So I began writing this article, and it eventually turned into this book, where I really focused on the medicinal aspects of these plants, but then it also I began to see some threads in this in the different plants and where they're inhabiting and how they maybe help restoring these places where they live, because they often gravitate to those areas that have been disturbed by human development and construction. So there was many other aspects to these plants besides just the healing benefits that they provide, and many more potential ecological benefits have were shown to me.
One of the questions that was brought up for me regarding your chapter on which you called the science of invasions was that since man has been bringing seeds and plants with him whenever he's transplanted himself, are there now guidelines or ways to know what species is good to transplant? And perhaps are there signs to let us know whether it's good to bring a plant somewhere or not?
The experts in the field of invasion biology really cannot predict which plants will potentially become invasive. And many of these plants have been here in the continental United States for hundreds of years, and originally brought with the settlers and spread through various means, often purposefully for good reasons. And only more recently have we seen that these plants are spreading, really expanding their scope of habitat. Some of the benefits that they were originally planted for were, you know, out west, you know, a lot of the plants were there for windbreaks and for soil erosion control, and were planted there along highways. And with the increased destruction of these areas, these plants are opportunistic in these areas and move into these areas prolifically because they are able to heal these disturbed lands.
So I'm assuming that someone is doing the work where they're seeing very much that, for instance, if a certain plant has a root system that goes very deep and has certain mineral properties, perhaps, that it's a very synergistic relationship that's going on with soil and with the plant itself. And How much would you say this is actually either developed or being used from that vantage point?
Well, it's a very narrow focus that most biologists use, and there's many other perspectives from other scientists that, including soil scientists, further ecological scientists who look at it from a larger perspective, seeing how plants survive in different niches with different plant systems and how they rely on different soil microbes and how they actually enhance each other's ability to live in these areas.
And for instance, hemp is a plant that I'm aware of that has quite an amazing root system, to the point where if people would, where there are mudslides and they have houses built on precipices and things like that, that hemp can be quite a benefit in that sense. And it's, looking at how everything is becoming resistant to all the antibiotics, and of course we know with all the fertilizers, that's, that's an old story. Unfortunately, it's not a dead story, but it's an old story that most of us are aware of that are listening anyway today. Can you share some other things in particular that you know of that... let me lead into right now, perhaps you may have heard that we had quite a fire in and around Boulder in the mountains it came through. And maybe we could use that as an example of what we might see. I know you mentioned mullein in your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's certain plants that move into these areas like after a fire. And mullein is one of those plants who often... you see, in a way, invading those lands and covering those lands after a fire. And those plants are actually helping stabilize the soils and regenerate the nutrients into the soil, helping build biomass. And, after a few years, often these plants then move on and all their species move in. And so, and another example is... like thistles.
Yes.
The thistle is one that is probably in those areas. And thistle is often seen moving into those areas that have been over-ranged. Too much livestock has been moving in there. And you see thistle coming in to help protect those lands. And with its deep root systems, they begin to reach in and bring out nutrients to the surface of the soil and break up the hard pan soils and thereby nourishing it. And these plants are also potentially helping with some of the toxicities that might have been there. And if there's mining in the area, oftentimes thistle moves in to help remediate some of these contaminants that have been that have accumulated in those areas.
Phytoremediation is certainly finally getting a name for itself and becoming more and more well known, and especially the rumbling since a lot of the oil spills in the ocean, for instance, could be really helped by phytoremediation. Is there a lot of development going on that you're aware of for this?
As far as I've seen, it's a fairly new science, and it has really just started in the 90s. And one of the exciting aspects that I found in this book is that there is a common thread with a lot of these invasive species in cleaning up different types of pollutants that have accumulated in and around us. One plant of particular note is Phragmites, the common reed that you find often growing in wetland systems and along culverts and ditches along roads. And this plant has been found to clean at least 15 heavy metals from the soil and all their hydrocarbons and explosives. And it's actually being used now in wastewater treatments, and different governments and agencies and corporations have been using this plant and discovering that it actually helps clean the water systems for the water runoff that goes into those areas. And so that leads to the prominence of this plant, one, because it handles these toxic environments, and in a way it has become so widespread that people are upset about that. But what's really happening is that it's reclaiming these areas that have been polluted so much that most of the native plants can't even survive there anymore. So this plant is actually rehabilitating these areas, and there's good reason why it's growing so prolifically with all the pollutants all around us.
Definitely. I'm glad it's finally getting recognized that that is what's going on. There's kind of a perfect system called nature going on.
Yes. You know, when I just started looking into the nature of phytoremediation, there is a concept that was new to me, which was natural attenuation. That's basically letting nature clean itself and allowing the plants that naturally grow in these areas to proliferate because they have this ability to handle these heavier toxicities. And in a way, that's a way they look for different plants for phytoremediation effects.
Of course, yeah.
Watching where they grow.
I know also a lot of the herbal lore, of course, came from watching animals in the wild to see what is going on with them and what they're eating in that particular moment. And then, so there's a lot to be gleaned, of course, through just observation. And that's, I think, the most powerful teacher of all, of course. If you look at an area, say it's becoming overgrown with this reed, for instance, and for very good reason, but I know you and your wife are developing your property, and I'm sure in as conscious a way as possible at the moment. And what would you do if you went to an area and you just saw, oh, all these reeds are growing up everywhere, but you didn't really want them to just, you know, 100% take over? Is there something you would, you know, what rationale would you use with what you do?
Yeah, so I'm not a proponent of spreading these plants by any means. And I myself, the land that we moved on to was a cleared house site about an acre and had been taken over by blackberry. And so a lot of my work over the last 7 or 8 years has been trying to open up space for gardens and removing the blackberry. And so, you know, it takes understanding first why they're there. And the blackberry was there to help protect this soil from washing away because it had been recently exposed. And so I have taken it to trying to remove the blackberry, but also replace it with plants that help stabilize the soil, like clovers and different grasses, and then the garden spaces. So, you know, and then leaving a space for the blackberry in which we can harvest their fruits. You know, I didn't want to completely get rid of it, and I knew there were benefits not only for eating, but also for medicine, too.
Right. Knowing what the blackberry was doing on the property, how did that speak to you from a medicinal standpoint? And I know you are quite well-respected health technician regarding the Lyme's disease, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But since we're on the blackberry, what did you kind of intuit and then work with that plant?
Well, I knew it was helping stabilize this area. And so in a way, it was protecting and nourishing the soil as well, because there wasn't much topsoil to to begin with. It's a very rocky area. So it was helping hold things together there, and in the long term, helping build biomass in the area. And eventually, if it was let go, the tree species would return, and it would become a forest over the course of time. So with me wanting to keep it open, I saw that the blackberry was, in a way, nourishing the soil and helping regenerate the land in a way so that the native species could come back if they were allowed to.
So how would you define a native species? Isn't it just a question of time, really, if a plant can thrive in a certain area?
Yes, the whole concept of native is really difficult to translate in our short human time spans. You know, the native is a concept that has been brought about, and the way it's been defined is a plant that has grown in the area previously or currently grows in the area and was... And opposite to that, the invasive exotic species are new plants to the area that really only started to come about to this continent 500 years ago when the European settlers came here. And, you know, native is a relative concept because what we've done to this continent over the last 400 years has really transformed it so dramatically that the ecosystems are not anywhere near like they were 500 years ago. We've cleared most all the forests, and in New England here, after clearing the forest, there were rangelands, and sheep and cattle were brought in, and that dramatically changed the composition of the soil and the health of the soil. And so with that change, it's hard to automatically put back plants that were there previous to that clearing and that.
Right. That's very wise. I mean, there's no going back.
There is no going back. And, you know, I'm in a way trying to restore that where I live, but I know that it's an impossible concept to fully create. You know, it's a complete different mix of tree species and plant species at this point.
Exactly. And so, once again, it takes a lot of observation to see, oh, well, what will do well here? What will be well here for its surrounding and vice versa?
Right.
Yeah, pretty interesting, and I think very wise to know that. You know, there's no going back, so where can we move to from here? I loved in your book, you know, it's a great read. We'll talk maybe about some of the plants that you list in the back in a little while. But for instance, I love that the nickname for common plantain in both Native American and Chinese languages is translated to mean white man's footprint.
Yes.
Did they consider the common plantain something bad, or was it just a name they gave it that the white man brought it?
I think, again, that was due just to observation. They saw that, you know, where the carts had moved on and created trails, the plantain popped up. And so instead of getting mad, you know, most of these native peoples made use of the plant as
sure.
good medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was more an observation, and this plant is more an expression of the land and where it lives. And it lives in those along the trail and roadsides and where there has been disturbance by the human foot, essentially.
Yeah. As I mentioned before, one of your specialties in your practice is working with Lyme disease. What correlations have you been able to make between invasive plants and invasive diseases?
Well, one of my main motivating factors to writing this book was because I was using Japanese knotweed extensively in my practice to treat Lyme disease. This was brought to my attention by Stephen Buhner and his book, Healing Lyme. And he acutely observed that Japanese knotweed has spread in nearly the same trajectory and at the same rate as Lyme disease has spread throughout the Northeast. And I, in fact, found some maps to prove that, and it seems to outline the same regions. And so knotweed was chosen as one of the main herbs for Lyme disease for its antimicrobial properties, for its ability to enhance immune systems, and it also contains the component resveratrol, and in fact is the plant that contains more resveratrol than any others in the world. So a very potent antioxidant and central nervous system tonic, helping the brain. And so this was specific for the central nervous system issues of Lyme disease. And I have found it to be very helpful with most everyone. And you know, I started by harvesting the knotweed myself, and it quickly showed that I couldn't really keep up with the demand for it. So I have people harvest it for me now.
What do you do with it? How do you use it? Do you steep it in water for long amounts of times, or how is it used?
It's the root that's used as medicine, and I have been putting it, grinding it up into powder and putting it into capsules for ease of use for folks.
Oh, okay.
You know, it can be easily decocted and made as a strong tea, no problem. And some people make it into a tincture with alcohol. And for my purposes, it seemed best to have it in encapsulated form to make it easier for folks to take on the long-term basis.
Is there a plant that you would put a hex on if you could from being in a certain area?
Oh, a hex, no. I think they're all here for good reason.
Okay, good answer.
there's many things we're still yet to learn about them, too. So even some of the most widely dispersed, you know, purple loosestrife is a plant that has a really bad reputation, and especially here in the Northeast, and people go after it with a lot of vengeance. And I found that, yes, even though this plant has taken over extensive stands of wetlands and many other species are not living there with it, I found it to be, again, more an expression of the place in which it's grown. And it's one of those plants, again, that is able to withstand heavy contamination in the water systems, the excess nitrogen and phosphorus from agricultural runoff. So it seems to be invading these areas, but under the surface, it's actually helping clean these areas. And one of the reasons those other plants can't survive there is because they cannot handle the excess toxicities that purple loosestrife can. So, and in addition to that, it is a valuable medicine and has the ability to even help other endangered plants, native medicinal species. In this case, it's eyebright is an endangered species that this plant can replace in its medicine, with its medicine.
Is it possible that I noticed, for instance, this morning that there is an endangered species article in a magazine from the Wild Earth Guardians. I guess they put out this publication. And in a way, I find this type of thinking and acting presumptuous. And, you know, I know eyebright has certainly been a very useful plant for herbalists throughout time, really. And do you think it's possible that it's giving way now to another plant that's going to be more potent for what's going on today on the planet, for both the actual physical Earth and what a human might use it for? Do you think it's a natural? I mean, obviously, humans are helping this natural process move more quickly.
Can't be
but
separated from it.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I think, you know, what I found with a lot of, most all these plants is that they are extremely potent antimicrobial plants and have those abilities to deal with infections and infectious disease. And that is one of the things that is becoming more and more common with our health, is that there's more and more infections and rampant disease out there. And these plants are, I find, very potent herbal antibiotics in a way.
Right. Is there a plant that you take as a tea or tincture or capsule daily? I would imagine that you kind of switch things around. What's something that you would really recommend highly to folks as we close out here today?
My favorite is Japanese knotweed, and I do use it on a regular basis. And I use it more as a tonic to strengthen my immune system over time and to help extract that antioxidant resveratrol. You see pharmaceutical companies making millions and billions of dollars off of this single component. And most of these pharmaceutical companies are extracting this component from this plant.
They're missing out on a lot, aren't they?
Yes, they are by extracting this component. I'm not a fan of those concentrated compounds, but just I do feel the whole plant has many other compounds involved in there, too, with all their effects. And so Japanese knotweed, I have a strong affinity to taking, not only for helping keep me strong, but it's also, I'm using it more also as for a preventative of Lyme disease, too. I do live in an epidemic area of that.
Yes. Well, I was just thinking, well, how lucky everyone is in Vermont that they're close to you, but I do know also that you do phone consults, and certainly a lot of information can be gleaned through your book.
Yes, it's become my main areas of focus these days, Lyme disease and talking to folks all around. And it is one of those diseases that is rampant and expanding and is in similar ways like some of the other growing antibiotic-resistant infections that are spreading as well. With that, you know, I feel the Japanese knotweed, for me, is in this area for a reason. And just like in Boulder, there's all their plants around there that are more specific to what's going on to the people there. And so these plants have been arriving for us to use for a long time, and people have noticed that when you need a plant, it does arrive there for you.
Invasive Plant Medicine with Timothy Lee Scott. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.